Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Who were the sons of God in the book of Genesis, and what did they do? The elusive text of Genesis 6, 1 through 4, with its references to sons of God, daughters of men, and giants, has perplexed interpreters for ages. In his book, The Sons of God in Genesis 6, 1 through 4, Jaap Dudens offers a comprehensive history and analysis of the various proposals for understanding the sons of God episode. He also evaluates the expression sons of God within its ancient Near Eastern context, and sets forth his own understanding of the message and function of Genesis 6, 1 through 4. Join us as we talk with Jaap Dudens about this fascinating, albeit difficult text, Genesis 6 and the Sons of God. You're listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Michael Morales. Jaap Dudens is College Associate Professor at Papa Reformed Theological Seminary in Hungary. He's published articles on the Old Testament, the Intertestamental Period, and the New Testament in English, Dutch, and Hungarian. Jaap, welcome to New Books in Biblical Studies.
Thank you very much.
As we begin, let me read for us the text of Genesis 6, 1 through 4 for the sake of our discussion. I'm reading from the New King James Version. Now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Jaap, what first interested you in this enigmatic passage?
Well, probably just the fact that it's a very enigmatic passage. I did my master's thesis on the first chapter of Genesis, so I was looking for studying that further. But then I was thinking that, well, I should do some or have some variation as well. Of course, I didn't stumble on that passage because I knew it. But I was thinking, it's probably one of the most difficult passages of the Old Testament. Maybe not in explaining the grammatical side of it, but as to content, it's one of the most difficult, very small passages, and a very compact story as well, or a very compact narrative as well. So that was more a kind of challenge, I think, to say that, well, then let's take the most difficult thing.
Now tell us a little bit more about yourself.
I'm Dutch, so I'm born in the Netherlands, but now at the moment, presently, I'm an associate professor at the Papa Reformed Theological Seminary in Papa, Hungary.
Would you offer us a brief summary on the main approaches to understanding the sons of God in Genesis 6?
Well, as to the explanation or the interpretation of the text, I think the expression "sons of God" is of course the most basic problem. That if you solve that, then most of the pieces of the puzzle find their place. When we have a look at the history of exegesis, then the main lines of exegesis are that there are two main solutions that these sons of God, of the sons of God, are superhuman, beings, or they are humans, human beings. And that can be split up in two, or so in the end, four lines of exegesis. If you take the superhuman side, then it is about angels, or about more generally divine beings or heavenly beings. And if you say they are in some way or another, they are human beings, or the text is telling us something about a narrative about human beings, then they are viewed during the history of exegesis as either judges or mighty persons, rulers, or as the sons of Seth, the son of Adam and Eve, and that means that they are seen as the pious people who are the followers of God. So these are the main lines of exegesis when we have a look at the text.
Let's turn first to the sons of God as angels interpretation, or the heavenly category, as you put it. What's the history of this understanding?
Well, the angels, so-called, or what I call the angels interpretation, is the oldest interpretation that we find in the history of exegesis, and of course it came into existence by comparison with other texts in the Old Testament, where, for example, most clearly in the beginning of the prologue of the book of Job, where they easily can be seen, because the same term is used as sons of God, who appeared before God, and then they were talking about, and among them was also Satan. This became the model, or they easily could be explained as being angels, and then they said that okay, the text in Genesis 6:1-4 is also about angels. So this is the oldest exegesis we find in both in Jewish and in Christian exegesis.
Tell us about some of the strengths and weaknesses of this heavenly category.
Well, the strength of the heavenly category is, of course, the fact that when we compare the expression sons of God in Hebrew to the other texts in which similar or the same expression occurs, and there are some texts, so we are not only looking to Genesis 6, then we see that it appears to be all of them are about heavenly beings, or let's say angels. So that's the strength of this exegesis, that it puts the sons of God into the heavenly realm. So that would be the main argument and the main strength of the hypothesis. Perhaps the weaker point is that when we use the term angels in Hebrew, they are really the attendants of God, or the messengers of God who are sent out, and they have a special task, and they seem to act really out of order within this chapter by going to earth, to having a sexual relationship with women, and children, giant children are born, and it's a very strange story. How we wouldn't expect that from angels. So that is one of the weaknesses, and probably also the reason why in the course of the history of exegesis, both in Jewish and in Christian circles, the exegetes just left this explanation behind. Perhaps also as a kind of demythologization of the whole story.
Another popular interpretation is that the sons of God refers to the line of Seth, or what you refer to as the religious category. What's the pedigree for this understanding?
This is also a very, very ancient interpretation. When we see the sons of God as the sons of Seth, this whole interpretation hinges on the interpretation of Genesis 4:26, especially in the Septuagint version. In Greek, it can be read as, and it's about Enos, the son of Seth, and in Greek you can read the verb what is used there. So the text is, he hoped to invoke or to be called with the name of the Lord God, meaning that if you read what is in most translations, I think from the Hebrew, that they in those days they began to invoke the name of the Lord. That is clear. But if you say that he hoped to be called by the name or with the name, or he hoped to be called God or Lord, then they say that, yeah, okay. So if Enosh, the son of Seth, was called God or could be called God, then his sons or his children or his children or his descendants also can be called sons of Enosh, being sons of God. So, and this is then in this way, and it was explained in a very much in a way that these people were the pious people who in a world full of sin were still living very close to paradise, and they were seduced by the daughters of Cain, who seduced them, and they went down, they came out of their closeness to paradise, and they lost their destination, let's say that. So that's the core of the Setites exegesis.
Yeah, what do you consider to be this view's strengths and weaknesses?
I do not see so much strength in that, even if it has been very popular. I think at least I knew this interpretation from my youth. I think in Reformed churches it was one of the, I don't know, accepted, but it was one of the explanations that you could hear. And then, of course, there was that everybody could refer to the texts that call the Israelites children of God or sons of God. But then there is a problem that all the Israelites were called children of God. So meaning that there were males and females among those children, of course. And here in this case, it's only about males, because the other side is the daughters of men. And also when the Old Testament talks about God's children or Israel as God's people, then it's not because of their piety or it's about the relationship that God chose them. And it's about that. And in a lot of cases, they are not so pious at all, as we know from the Old Testament.
You assessed all the major views in the history of interpretation and performed your own exegetical analysis. Tell us now about your own conclusions. Who are these sons of God?
Well, when we have a look at the ancient Near Eastern material and literature, then it turns out that similar terms are used to refer to or divine beings or deities. And when we have a look at all the Old Testament material in which this term is used, so sons of God, then in all cases, a reference to divine beings or deities or heavenly beings fits the context. And it's maybe the most clear, okay, this is Aramaic and not Hebrew, but when we have a look at Daniel 3:25, then you have the story of the friends of Daniel who are thrown into the fire, and they are alive there, and the king sees another person walking in the fire, and he says, and his look is like a son of the gods, and then later on this same word is explained as God sent his angel. But that means that the expression son of God or sons of God is a broader term. So it's not so specific for angels as God's messengers or even the term angels, or at least in Hebrew and Greek, is used for human messengers as well. But anyhow, the term sons of God or son of God in Daniel 3 is a broader term. So meaning that it's more unspecified. A heavenly figure is walking there. A heavenly being is there, or a divine being, someone who is belonging to another dimension or to the realm of heaven, and not to the realm of earth. So it's a little bit broader than angels. So that is what I think we should read this text in Genesis 6 as well. Of course, you get a lot of especially theological problems, I think, when reading it this way, and you can ask questions about what does it mean when we say that the Old Testament is still or the Old Testament is of course always referring to God in a very monotheistic way. So how can this be possible? But anyhow, that's our problem that we may have to solve, or maybe we cannot solve. But anyhow, I think we should accept the text as it is, and try to find at least based on the text the best explanation for it.
So, Yap, how would your view regarding the divine beings relate to the rest of the story, the daughters of men and the giants or the Nephilim that were born to them?
Well, I use the metaphor in my book of ancient cartographers, meaning that if you have a look at ancient maps of the world, that the closer you are to your cartographer draw a map, and the closer it is to his own environment, the more precise the map is, and the further away from his own place. Of course, it's different now because we have Google Earth and whatever, we have satellites and can make very precise maps. But for them, it was quite a job. And the further they were away from home, the more imprecise or insecure the map did become. And this is also something with when we read the first chapters of Genesis, that this is a story that I think by Israelites they probably wouldn't have seen it as a kind of what we would call myth, so as a fancy story about strange things, but that they would have taken it seriously, but still they wouldn't have seen it or considered it to have the same literary value as, let's say, a passage from the Book of Kings, which is far more a kind of chronicle. So we go far back in history, and there is probably also some archetypical side to these texts that we should take into account. If we look at from in that way, then I think we could say that If you read the beginning of Genesis, the story about paradise and what is classically called the fall of humanity, then this resulted in two problems, namely first the problem that people became alienated from God and from each other. So humanity became fractured, and in the 11th chapter of Genesis, when we have the story of the Tower of Babel, it seems that humanity is looking for a solution for the problem of fracturing, they want to stay together and build for themselves a real name and power, And so that's the one side of the problem that is caused by what happened in this written in Genesis 3, and Genesis 6 probably does this in a similar way, but then referring to the other side, the alienation from God, and here a human solution is found for people connecting to the heavenly realm. Probably also they have in view that maybe immortality can be reached for them, or anyhow they find some heavenly power. You have these giants that are born. Both Genesis chapter 11 and 6 may be stories, narratives about human solutions for the problem that's existed since what happened as it was written in Genesis 3. And then we read on and we get the story of Abraham, and then God says that, okay, I will give a solution for this problem, and I will bless him, and so the connection to God is restored, and he will be a blessing for all the peoples of the world, and so the problem of humanity and the fracturing of humanity is restored, or will be restored anyhow. That's the perspective that Genesis 12 when it's about the vocation of Abraham, that this perspective is given. And interestingly, in all of these stories, so in Genesis 12, and it's about Abraham, but also in Genesis 6 and in 11, one of the keywords is the word name in Hebrew. So we will make a name for ourselves by building this tower and city. We will, the giant. The giants, they were the men of renown, but the word name is used. They were famous. Is used in Genesis 6, and then in Genesis 12, when it's about Abraham, that God says, "Yeah, that I will give you a name in the world." So I try to see or to connect these narratives to each other. Of course, this is mainly a literary approach, or a narrative approach. But I think, there is some base for it.
Before saying goodbye, Jaap, can you tell us about any new projects you're working on? Any other work on Genesis 6?
Not especially in Genesis 6. I think it was enough for now. Although new literature, you can always find new things. Or have new ideas. So maybe if suddenly I wake up and I say that, well, it's a great idea, I will maybe I'll write an article about it. No, I'm now especially busy with a project with chaos and order in the Old Testament and in the ancient Near East. So that's one of my bigger projects now.
Yep, it's been great speaking with you about your recent book, The Sons of God in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. All the best for you.
All right, friends, you've been listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.